Keep up to date with the past on the 100 Years Ago Show with Mark Stein.
Millinery mayhem in Manhattan. The bonds of matrimony are loosened, and the most expensive picture ever made. It's September 1922.
100 years from today.
News update. The messy aftermath of the Great War continues. Can it really be possible in the modern era that a nation should lose both its prime minister and its monarch within a couple of days? That's what could be underway in Greece right now. From Paris, the former prime minister, Eleftherios Venizelos, has announced that he would be willing to form a new government if the current prime minister, Nikolaos Triantafylakos, resigns and King Constantine abdicates. A so-called revolutionary committee is reported to have been formed by disaffected army officers, and both the prime minister and his majesty are said to be feeling the heat. For the king, it would be his second abdication, and the odds of a second restoration are not good. The court and the politicians are in this pickle because of their humiliation in the Greco-Turkish War. Mustafa Kemal's troops have swept into Smyrna and effectively ended the war on the ground against the Greeks, that is. Troops of the World War allies have now landed at Çanakkale on the southern shore of the Dardanelles at their narrowest point, and near to the site of the ancient city of Troy. The purpose of the Allied intervention is to set up a neutral zone between Greece and Turkey, but Turkish forces continue to advance, and the British government has threatened Turkey with war. A Royal Navy fleet is en route, but so are the Russian Bolsheviks, reported to be headed south in support of Kemal Pasha. In Smyrna itself, foreign residents report that a massacre of the Armenians is now underway. The new Turkish governor, Nureddin Pasha, is said to be hunting down Armenians, rounding them up in batches of 100, taking them to Konak and murdering them. Bearded Nureddin, as the Turkish strongman is known, is a somewhat careless butcher. In their bloodlust, Turkish troops lit fires in the Armenian quarter of the city in order to drive residents out of their homes. Then the wind changed direction, and the fires blew into non-Armenian neighborhoods, afflicting the general population. So far, another 10,000 persons are reported dead in the fire. More news of Turkish minorities. In this overwhelmingly Muslim nation, a new Christian church has been founded in Kayseri in Anatolia. The Turkish Orthodox Church will conduct its services in the Turkish language and protect the Christian faith in Turkey. Its first patriarch is Pavlos Karahisarathis, who will take the regnal name of Papa Eftim. More Turkish news. Notwithstanding the reported Armenian massacres in Smyrna, the Treaty of Kars has been ratified in Yerevan, setting the boundary between Turkey and the Georgian Soviet Socialist Republic and the Armenian Soviet Socialist Republic. The war's messy aftermath continues beyond the Caucasus and the Dardanelles. In Berlin, the German Chancellor, Josef Wirth, has declared his priorities. Quote, bread first, reparations second. In Bolshevik Russia, in hopes of averting a split within the Communist Party leadership, Comrade Lenin proposed that Comrade Trotsky become his deputy on Sovnarkom, the Council of People's Commissars. But Mr. Trotsky has declined to accept the invitation.
All that are out of Ireland, let their happy feelings flow like the old river channels. Oh,
The new army of the incoming Irish Free State is having a difficult time putting the cork back in Ireland. September is not going so well for the not-yet-born state. The Free State's enemy in the Irish Civil War, the Irish Republican Army, has overrun the National Army's garrison at Drumshanbo in County Leitrim and also taken Ballina, about 60 miles west in County Mayo. The nascent Irish state is pushing back. The former Royal Air Force base at Gormanston has been more recently a Royal Irish Constabulary garrison for their auxiliary forces, the so-called Black and Tans, the last Black and Tans left in August, and Gormanston has now been transformed into an internment camp for hundreds of captured Irish Republicans. In Dublin, the Court of King's Bench has denied an application for a writ to free Republican prisoners from incarceration by the Free State Army. Sir Thomas Maloney, the Lord Chief Justice of Ireland, says a state of war exists in the country and thus habeas corpus is suspended. Sir Herbert Samuel, the first practicing Jew ever to serve in a British cabinet, has taken the oath of office as High Commissioner of Palestine and Commander-in-Chief of all British forces there. He has been de facto Chief Executive for 2 years, but only now has the British Mandate of Palestine been officially constituted. Sir Herbert is the first Jew to govern the historic land of Israel in 2,000 years, and his formal appointment has revived concerns from the Christian and Muslim communities. Field Marshal Lord Allenby, who liberated Palestine from the Ottoman Empire and who regarded the choice of Sir Herbert as extremely dangerous, was nevertheless present in Jerusalem for the ceremony, as was the Emir Abdullah of Transjordan, the Hashemite sheikh whom British administrators have decided to favour in the eastern part of the new mandate. More sheikhs. It is not so long since Sheikh Mahmoud Barzanji of the Qadariya Order of Sufis led a revolt against the British in Kurdistan and was exiled to India. However, Turkish supporters of Mustafa Kemal, now heady with victory over Greece, are said to be eyeing the possibility of retaking Mosul. So Sir Percy Cox, High Commissioner of Iraq, has recalled Sheikh Barzanji from exile and installed him as governor of the Kurdish lands in hopes of preventing either a terrorist insurgency or a Kemalist attack. More internal housekeeping in the British Empire, this time under the South Sea Moon. Ascension Island in the South Atlantic is 800 miles from its fellow British colony, St Helena. But for government purposes, the former has now been made a dependency of the latter. The Board of Admiralty will hand over administration of Ascension Island to the Eastern Telegraph Company, which runs the submarine cables connecting London with its territories in southern Africa. Tootsie, hello? In the United States, about one-third of the railway companies have reached an agreement with the striking shopmen, and that means the trains are back, some of them, as the nationwide railroad strike is beginning to ameliorate somewhat, with restored service on at least 30 of the 202 Class 1 railroad lines, including the New York Central, the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul, the Chicago, Rock Island, and Pacific, the Baltimore and Ohio Ohio, the Seaboard Line, and the Norfolk and Western.
It's the hat my dear old father wore upon St. Patrick's Day. Talk about respect with his head erect as he marched along Broadway. Not a man in line looked half so fine, my dear old mother used to say, as your father did with that old time lit upon St. Patrick's Day.
Sharon Bigara, it's the hat my father wore on St. Patrick's Day, but if he's still wearing it after Labor Day, better look out. In New York, a gang of youths has begun assaulting dock workers still wearing their straw hats. On the city docks, the tradition is for workers to switch from straw hats to felt hats at the end of summer, and the mildly irritating pastime of ne'er-do-wells knocking the millinery off the heads of those who fail to comply has now expanded into full-blown beatings of the straw-hatted. The so-called Straw Hat Riot began in Mulberry Bend in the Five Points in Lower Manhattan, but is now bringing motor traffic to a standstill on the Manhattan Bridge at the northern end of the island.
He'd have to get under, get out and get under, to fix his little machine. He was just dying to cuddle his queen, but every minute when he'd begin it, he'd have to get under, get out and get under. Then he'd get back at the wheel. A dozen times they'd start to hug and kiss, and then the darned old engine, it would miss, and then he'd have to get under, get out and get under, and fix up his automobile.
If you have to get under, get out and get under, take a good look at your tire, because it might well be Canadian. 4 years after the incorporation of the Firestone Tire and Rubber Company of Canada Limited, the company has produced the very first Canadian-made automotive tire manufactured in Hamilton, Ontario. On the very same day, two brothers, William and Alfred Billers, combined their meager savings and purchased Hamilton Tire and Garage Limited. They planned to sell tires at a discount by buying at low cost during the winter months and marking up the prices to sell at a profit in the summer.
Of the west, where the best is like the worst, where the wrong to the ten commandments, and a man can pay the best.
Right now, we fancy Rudyard Kipling would very much like to be shipped somewhere east of Suez. An interview of Mr. Kipling by Claire Sheridan in the New York World has caused an uproar in the United States. Miss Sheridan quotes the famous British writer as saying that America had entered the war, quote, 2 years, 7 months, and 4 days too late, and had then, quote, quit the day of the armistice without waiting to see the thing through. Mr. Kipling asserts he made the remarks in what he thought to be a private conversation, and so has publicly denied he ever gave Miss Sheridan any such thing as an interview.
What a beautiful day.
What a beautiful day.
For a wedding in May.
For a wedding in May.
See the people all stare.
Just see them stare.
At the lovable pair.
He's
a vision of joy.
He's a vision of joy.
He's the luckiest boy.
He's the luckiest boy.
In his wedding array.
In his wedding array.
Hear him smilingly say.
What does he say?
The bells are ringing.
In a ring, in a ring.
For me and my gal.
And
the birds are singing.
In a ring, in a ring.
For me and my gal.
For me and my gal.
Everybody's been knowing. To a wedding they're going, and for weeks they've been sewing, every Tuesday and down, they're congregating, for me and my gal,
surprise.
The parson's waiting,
at the gate,
for me and my gal, and sometime I'm gonna build a little home for you, for three or four, or more, in some land.
That's That's all very well, but is your gal a little squeamish about pledging to love, honour and obey you? The House of Bishops of the Episcopal Church seems to think American women are not too comfortable with vowing to obey their menfolk, and in Portland, Oregon, the bishops have voted to amend the Book of Common Prayer's language for weddings to eliminate the requirement. The vote was 36 to 27 in favour, but many of the dissenting bishops regard the revised language as disturbing. "I stand for the solidarity of the family," says Bishop Bratton of Mississippi, "and every family must have a head." But other clerics want the updated vows backdated, says Bishop Beckwith of Alabama. "I move something be done to release all the women who have already taken the vow to obey." Have you seen When Knighthood Was in Flower? It is set back in the days when women seriously had to obey. And at a cost of $1.5 million, it is said to be the most expensive picture ever made. William Randolph Hearst has produced it for his favourite leading lady, Marion Davis, and it features her in the role of Mary Tudor, who was forced by her brother, Henry VIII, to marry King Louis XII of France instead of the man she loves. For its premiere at the Criterion Theatre in New York, Mr. Hearst has mounted the world's most lavish publicity campaign, buying over 650 advertising billboards and 300 subway placards, and commissioning this special waltz by the Dean of Broadway Operetta Composers, Victor Herbert. Be the next Marion Davis. She was already a great success with Germany's famous UFA studios, but Paramount Pictures is confident her appeal is transatlantic and have signed her up. The first movie actress from continental Europe to be brought across the ocean and promoted to stardom in America. Remember that name, Pola Negri. Enough with these painted queens of the silver screen. Last year, the producer Hal Roach was auditioning a young girl and despaired at how over-made up and over-rehearsed she was. After the little madam had left, Mr. Roach looked across the street to a lumberyard where a gaggle of boisterous young tykes was attempting to take a large stick away from the smallest boy. The producer realised that he'd just spent a quarter hour watching kids just being kids, and decided to make a series of two-reelers showing just that. He is calling them his R-Gang comedies, starring Hal Roach's Rascals. The first one is out now. It is called One Terrible Day. We feel reasonably confident in saying these lilting tunes will soon be wafted around the world. They're from the brand new operetta Madame Pompadour, which had its world premiere in Germany at the Berliner Theatre with the composer himself, Leo Fall, conducting. Herr Fall is the acclaimed creator of such worldwide theatrical sensations as The Merry Farmer, The Dollar Princess and The Rose of Stamboul. Publishing news. The Council on Foreign Relations was founded last year for diplomats, academics and financiers, but it would like to reach a wider audience, and so it has launched a periodical called Foreign Affairs. The lead article in the very first issue by former Secretary of State Root argues that America is now a world power, and as such, the general population needs to be much better informed about international affairs. Melbourne Victoria has a new newspaper. Hugh Dennison, proprietor of the Sydney Sun, has launched a morning paper in Melbourne, the Sun News Pictorial, intended to challenge the dominance of the Melbourne Herald under its dynamic new editor, Keith Murdoch.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd. Oh, buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack. I don't care if I never get back.
In sports news, after this ball game, they will never be back. In front of a capacity crowd, the New York Yankees swept a doubleheader against the Philadelphia Athletics. An estimated 25,000 fans were turned away at the gate. Why so many? Because it was the last ever Yankees game at the Polo Grounds. Next season, they will be at their own purpose-built Yankee Stadium. In Stockholm, Paavo Nurmi, the famous flying Finn, has broken his own world record in the men's 5,000 metres with a new world record of 14 minutes 35.4 seconds. No such title holding for Johnny Buff, the American flyweight boxing champ at Ebbets Field in New York City. After a barrage of blows, two knockdowns, and a series of uppercuts, Mr. Buff has lost his title in an 11th round technical knockout to his Filipino challenger, Pancho Villa. Boxing, running, baseball, sure, whatever. But for real sport, you can't beat chaps on horseback with mallets. In Buenos Aires, the devotees of such antics have formed the Argentine Polo Association with the goal of creating a national polo team to compete around the world.
Some sunny day, with a smile on my face, I'll go back to that place far away. Back to that shack and that red-headed hen. She'll say, how have you been? Then go back to the hay and lay me my breakfast. Some sunny day, in a fall of a bird, I'll fly away to the sweetest little thing on earth, my mammy. Oh, how I pine for those lips sweet as wine. They'll be pressed close to mine some sunny day.
That was Some Sunny Day at El Azizia in the Italian colony of Tripolitania. In fact, it was the hottest day ever recorded on our planet, 136.4 degrees Fahrenheit, which is over 2 degrees hotter than the previous hottest temperature, 134.1 degrees, recorded in Death Valley, California, just 9 years ago. The Americans are not happy at losing the world record, and there are rumors that the weather station at El Azizia was moved from the town to a hilltop fort and set up on black tar macadam, which absorbs sunlight and therefore makes the temperature higher. In addition, the station's regular mercury thermometer is said to have been replaced by a cruder thermometer of the kind used in domestic greenhouses. None of these shenanigans would ever happen at American weather stations. Not such a sunny day on the German steamship Harmonia, which foundered off the coast of Spain. Another ship, the Kinfons Castle, rescued 383 persons, including the captain. But the passenger list went down with the ship. So Captain Hofer of the Harmonia says only 15 people have been lost, according to his calculations. But Captain Day of the Kinfons Castle says he saw two lifeboats overturn and at least 80 people die. And others say as many as 150 are dead. The precise number will likely never be known. Mary Ann Booth was an American entomologist and microscopist. Her own illness and long home confinement caused her to acquire expertise in the preparation of slides for human parasites, and she was recognized as having the largest collection of microscopic photographs of microorganisms. She also prepared the micrographs used by Rupert Blue to stop the spread of bubonic plague in San Francisco. Miss Booth is dead at 79. 1899. Annie Royal Taylor was an English explorer and missionary. In late 1892, she became the first white woman ever to penetrate Tibet. Despite being cold and without food and with most of her horses dead, she intended to press on to the forbidden city of Lhasa, but was apprehended by Tibetan authorities and expelled. Miss Taylor is dead at 66. Wilfred Scawen Blunt was a poet and polemicist. He was a cousin of Lord Alfred Douglas, a fellow man of letters and coiner of the expression, "the love that dare not speak its name," although that coinage is frequently attributed to Lord Alfred's late friend Oscar Wilde. Mr. Blunt married the granddaughter of Lord Byron. If he never matched the eminence of his literary family, he lived a colourful life, preserving Arabian horse bloodlines at his stud and toying fitfully with conversion to Islam, although he is said to have died, as his Catholic friends predicted, with the wafer in his mouth. He was an anti-imperialist, and his best-known line is uttered by the devil in his poem Satan Absolved. It is a rebuke to Kipling, as if Mr. Kipling needs any more this week. Quote, "The white man's burden, Lord, is the burden of his cash." Wilfred Scawen Blunt is dead at 82. And that's the way of the world, September 1922.
100 years from today, 100 years from today.
The 100 Years Ago Show is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and O'Kill Media. All rights reserved.